The male brain is what we're talking about. Luann Brizendine, the doctor, and who is also a professor and also hosts the director of a clinic on female moods and hormones. And that brings us back to a discussion about depression, because as we've heard about in some research, that the mistake in treating depression is going with SSRIs when actually it may be as much of an imbalance in the brain from hormones. I want to ask Dr. Brizendine about that, and you get to ask whatever question you want to get to next, too, on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So Dr. Luann Brizendine, author of The Male Brain, let me just cut to the chase on that. I had a friend who had suffered from depression for many years, said that he got hooked up with a doctor who said your testosterone is about a third of what it should be for a guy your age. At the time, he was in his late 30s. He said, you've got the testosterone of a 60-year-old man. He went on a testosterone, you know, treatment, and he never looked back, never had depression again. And I've heard that they're doing the same sorts of things with women. Where are you with that?
Well, you know, like I talk about in the last chapter of the book, The Mature Male Brain, when testosterone levels do go down in men, below the level like it sounds like your friend was, there have been many studies that have shown that replacing the testosterone level to normal levels can help treat depression in those men that have the low level. So I think it's very important for men that have symptoms of both depression and of low testosterone, which is things like lack of libido and lack of erection, lack of interest in sex, basically are indications of having a low testosterone level, that they should have their testosterone levels measured, of course. And if then it happens to be very low, they should get treatment.
Well, in his case, though, and I'll just, again, I'm making a pitch for this in the sense that he swears by it, and other people I know who have done it said that it made a world of difference. And it wasn't just lack of interest in sex. It was a general listlessness. It was an irritability. Like the classic, you know, cranky old man down the street, get off my lawn kind of a thing. Everything bugged him. And when the testosterone came back, he was a lot more compliant about life. Things didn't bug him the same way they bugged him before. And he found that, you know, not only was he interested in sex, but he was back to interested in competing.
Right.
And he wanted to get back in the
life things he liked to do before. That's one of the biggest, you know, indications, of course, of lack of just the vivacity of life.
Right. But you haven't seen anything in your work with the hormone clinic that you are director of, where that's becoming more common for women to be treated for lack of testosterone?
Yes, we treat them as well. And often, you know, I have a lot of couples who come to my clinic, and I'll get the phone call usually from the woman saying, Dr. Brizendine, you got to save my marriage. You know, it's usually the call, and it says,
right.
Basically, my husband says, if I don't get more interested in having sex with him, he's going to leave me. They come in, and of course, they're sitting in my office, and I'll say to him, John, how do you know Mary loves you? And he'll say, oh, because she wants to have sex with me.
Right.
I'll say to Mary, how do you know
right.
John loves you? And she'll say, oh, well, because he wants to cuddle and talk with me.
But didn't that speak to, I read something earlier this week when I was researching your book, and I came across this story about how men are one of the psychological reasons that men roll away from women after sex, and why women seek cuddling statistically, is that they're after sex, women tend to feel more vulnerable and they need reassurance that what they did was okay. And the guy needs to detach a little bit so that he feels less like he has to be responsible for somebody else, and that he can balance out that sense of attachment. Does that sound right to you?
No, actually, there's something a little more deeply biological in that, in a way that males after ejaculation have a big burst of oxytocin in their brain. It's not OxyContin, that's oxytocin.
Right.
Which is a hormone, it's called the cuddle hormone, but also puts the male brain to sleep. And we have the technical term for that is post-coital narcolepsy.
Right.
It puts the male brain to sleep. So he rolls over and goes to sleep.
Well, and I'm good with that, but I guess the question that I was exploring when I was looking it up was, why do men roll over and go to sleep? And there was more than just the physiological. There was a sense that hardwired in to males' brains, at least according to this guy, was the thought that they needed to detach slightly after sex, that made them feel more vulnerable, and so now they have to start to kind of build up the wall a little bit afterward. But that doesn't sound like you buy that.
That may be so. That would be a hard study to do.
Okay,
it would be an interesting one to find out about. Yes.
Let's do John in Lima, Ohio. He's got a question for Dr. Luann Brizendine, author of The Male Brain. Hey, John.
Hi, Ian. Hi, Doctor.
Hi, what's John. How are you tonight?
What's your male brain telling you to ask?
Oh, there's so many things, but I'd like to kind of dispel the notion of a merely physical, emotionless man. I was watching with some interest Oprah Winfrey, and a gentleman that was on there, and I can't recall his name or his credentials. I believe he was a family therapist, had made the comment that statistically, in many instances, the lady that the husband is having the affair with is not as physically attractive as the wife.
Right.
And, you know, so I guess I coined a phrase, maybe the ear that hears is more dangerous than the body that rocks.
There you go. Yeah.
And there's that sense of confirmation from that other woman that says, you're great. You're fantastic. Right? I mean, that's the belief and that sense of echoing what that guy really needs to hear, which is that he still has it.
Yeah. And for example, from my grandparents' standpoint, now my grandmother was a homemaker all of her life. My grandfather was the breadwinner who had the hobbies. And yet in 93, when they were both very much ill, I could not picture my grandfather without my grandmother, but I could picture it the other way around. And I thought, well, there goes the theory of it's merely physical. There's no emotion.
Okay. Well, let's let Dr. Brizendine sort that out a little bit. So what would you say there to John's comment?
Thanks, John, for your comments. Very, very interesting observations that you make here. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I think is important to remember is that in any relationship, they have shown the Love Lab research up in Seattle for about 25 years of Dr. Gottman has shown that you need to be able to make about 4 positive statements to your partner for every 1 critical remark. So the point being that if you're not getting the positive reinforcement at home, and these guys sound like they're getting it elsewhere, and that's the part that they're needing more than just the physical, or that the affair is somebody that's more sexually attractive or more beautiful than the wife is. That does not seem to be the case. So thanks for that comment, John. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and we kind of see that a little bit with, you know, somebody who's married to a beautiful woman, but what he needs is he kind of needs, as the more he gets successful, perhaps, the more he, you know, that there's this rise in ego or a sense of insecurity as he gets more successful, that he seeks somebody that will just give him that sort of cheap assurance that you are cool and you are amazing. And, oh, look how much money you have. And, wow, look at that car. The things that the wife is just not inclined to want to confirm him for or be less likely to.
Right. We all need to be valued and we all need to be told, you know, about the good things that we do, too. Right. We need to be admired and cared for in that way.
Men are so shallow. Chuck, let's get Chuck in Alaska on Coast to Coast. Chuck, you're talking with Dr. Luann Brizendine.
Yes, fascinating subject. I've been long interested in the brain. We're adoptive and foster parents, and we get a lot of kids. Almost all of our children we've had through have had fetal alcohol from before birth and attachment disorders from after birth if they're a little older.
Right.
And My wife is just an expert at putting their lives back together. We've adopted, I think, five or six. I think we've got eight, but they're almost all girls except one boy. But I have noticed a difference, these problems in boys and girls in the way they are affected by especially fetal alcohol syndrome. And I'm also kind of interested in hyperactivity and that sort of thing. It seems like it's more common in boys. And if your guest could comment on those things, I'd appreciate it.
What about hyperactivity? That's a really good question.
Oh, yeah, thanks for that question, because I think one of the things that we know, we don't know why the male brain in boys is more susceptible to things, for example, like autism is between up to eight times more prevalent in boys than in girls. And Asperger's syndrome can be up to even 16 times more prevalent in boys than girls. And hyperactivity and learning disabilities, difficulty with academic work, 4 to 5 times more boys have those problems than girls in the grade school age. So we don't know why the male brain is more susceptible to these kinds of learning problems than the female, but we do know that that's the case.
Okay, but let's go back to what he's talking about, the adoption issues. I think that's very interesting, because his wife seems to be a kind of an innate mental pathologist. You're going to try to work, kind of have to go back retroactively and figure out what happened to this person that brought them, that led them to where they were. And that can't be, that's got to be hard, whether it's dealing with a boy or a girl.
Absolutely. I don't think it sounds like she has a real gift for helping these children. And, of course, kids that are born with fetal alcohol syndrome, have a brain that's not wired correctly because of that particular disability. So it sounds like she has a real gift for helping these kids.
First-time caller line, Evan is in Texas on Coast to Coast. Sorry, Evan, I didn't have my glasses on.
Yes, Evan? I heard you speak about how SSRIs are often misprescribed, and I was wondering if your guest knows anything about the long-term effects, if it calcifies the pineal gland and has long-term effects on a person's personality.
Good questions.
Well, thank you for that, Evan. That's a very interesting question. Of course, that the topic of SSRIs, which are, the serotonin drugs, for example, Prozac, Paxil, Celexa, all of the drugs that are used for both depression and anxiety disorder nowadays, there is some indication that particularly even in men who are not depressed, so just normal men, if you give them an SSRI, it makes them less aggressive and less competitive. So there's some personality change with those, yes.
But at the same time, do they really actually treat depression? This is a subject that we've talked a lot about on the show over the years, because it seems like the research just isn't there yet, really, after, despite all of the experimentation on the American public, that it may treat symptoms that may be related to depression, but does it actually treat the depression itself?
Well, we don't, because we don't know what the origin of depression is, like for diabetes, we know that there are cells in the pancreas, right, that die off and that causes diabetes. So we know the origin of a disease like that. Depression is a disease of the brain where we don't know the exact area and cause of the depression. We do know that things like the SSRIs can help to lift people's mood who are terribly depressed. These drugs are used to treat the symptoms
right.
of depression, but getting at what the core problem with the brain is, because we haven't discovered what that is yet.
Well, no surprise, we had a physician as esteemed as yourself several months ago who'd written a book after years of study that they didn't want to write, but came to the conclusion that as a medical physician, they could not justify giving anybody SSRIs anymore for just what you just said. We don't know what causes the depression, and yet all of the research says it's the placebo effect. The placebo works better statistically than the SSRIs. In which case, it's either works the same as or better than the SSRIs. And I find that interesting. I don't, again, it's not like I'm wailing on the SSRIs, but I do think it's...
Well, I think that one of that those things are complicated with the, you know, with the placebos and the SSRI issue, just because in the very beginning, the placebo often is as good as the drug. But if you do follow it out for up to a year with the placebo against the SSRI, for someone who has a bona fide real textbook case of clinical depression, you follow them out that year long of the SSRI, it does work better than the placebo over that period of time. So you're right, it's a confusing area, but I think that there are people out there whose lives have been saved by taking some antidepressants. So I think that the antidepressants really do have their place when they're carefully prescribed and carefully followed between the doctor and the patient in an ongoing fashion.
I will certainly concede to your point here, but I would tell you there's a doctor out there that has a lot of letters after his name too, and he says even after a year, the research doesn't bear out. But I'll leave that aside for now and just get to Kate in Bend, Oregon, on Coast to Coast. Kate, you're talking with Dr. Luann Brizendine.
Good evening. My question had to do with how men and women kind of fall on the fight or flight response scale. And the second part of that is I suspect women are more flight, but there's a certain wisdom in that that's kept us going for a while.
So thanks, Kate, for your question. It's a very interesting one. And you know, for 40 or 50 years, we thought that the fight or flight reaction was the same in males and females, but have now discovered that it isn't, and that men, the theory goes that probably in an evolutionary sense, men could do fighting the beast or fight someone or run away. But for females, it was a little different because she often was either pregnant or had young children or infants with her. So that some of that fight or flight reaction in females or that kind of situation where there's an infant or they're pregnant, they may turn and have a slightly different reaction, which is called the tend and befriend reaction, meaning that they stay within the group and will try to be close to other members of the group for protection. So there seems to be a little bit of difference in the fight or flight reaction. And thanks for that question. It's an interesting area of research.
I like tend or befriend. I've never even heard that. You've added something new to my vocabulary. Adrian is in Ontario, Canada, on Coast to Coast for Dr. Luann Brizendine. Adrian?
Hi, yes, Ian. I actually had a comment more than anything tonight. Earlier you mentioned I'm actually a young guy myself. I'm 23 years old. And you mentioned about the girls these days being more sexually aggressive than guys.
We talked about this statistically,
yeah.
Yes?
Yes, and I would like to agree with you entirely there. It's been like that ever since I was young. But here's my theory as to why, and I would just... I would like the doctor's comment on it as well. You also mentioned girls posting themselves on Facebook, but I wanted to mention the role that the media, I believe, plays on this. For example, there aren't any positive female role models these days on TV. For example, who do you have? You have Britney Spears, who came out with her first single, Hit Me Baby One More Time, where she's prancing around dressed up as a Catholic schoolgirl. You have her other songs.
Well, hang on. I tell you what, we're running up against the break here, Adrian, but I will do this. We'll pick up there. I'll ask Dr. Luann Brizendine about role models. That's a really good, that's an interesting subject. I don't know that I agree with you that there are no positive ones. The question is, are there popular positive ones? And are the positive ones that are popular, are they not more popular because of the media or because people are less interested in them? That we are maybe as teenagers drawn to scandal. We'll get to that coming up next in regard to the male brain, too, on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. The male brain, Luann Brizendine, is the author of the book about a breakthrough understanding of how men and boys think. We'll get back to that role model conversation. What works as a role model for boys and for girls. She's also the author of The Female Brain, Perfect Person to Ask. And the rest of your questions and comments about the male brain. How does it work? How does it not work? Why doesn't it work the way we think it's supposed to work? Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. We'll go open lines for the last hour of the show on Coast to Coast, or is that Toast to Toast if you're listening earlier this week? The book I was mentioning earlier, I couldn't think of it, but somebody sent me the link, The Emperor's New Drugs by Dr. Irving Kirsch. Very interesting. He says, exploding the antidepressant myth. It's out in hardcover since January. The Male Brain is just out from Dr. Luann Brizendine, A Breakthrough Understanding of How Men and Boys Think. And so the last caller before the break said that, you know, in a way we look at girls and how maybe how they have become more sexually aggressive in the way in which they're at least acting, maybe not in the way they've always been thinking, but in the way that they're acting. Part of that is about role models, but that brings me back to what about role models for boys and for girls? What works? Does that work, that kind of modeling behavior?
Well, I think that any time that we're surrounded by, you know, others, peers, family, church groups, school groups that are helping us be our best selves, that's what every person, every human being, and every kid needs. I think that lots of boys who are raised by single moms often don't have enough of a male role model in their life. And I think that male school teachers and male coaches really fill in that gap for those boys. The caller that we talked to before that was the 23-year-old fellow who called in and said he didn't feel that girls have very good role models out there for how to behave, and that they're all these sort of the teen girl idols right now are sort of selling aggressive female sexuality, and he was feeling that that is influencing their behavior. And of course, we all are influenced by the behavior of celebrities, people that we look up to, and people in our lives. So I think that your caller actually had a point there.
I think I'll go with that to a point. But I think that it's kind of a chicken egg thing. There's a reason why Britney Spears became so popular. It wasn't that the media sat up one night and said, hey, let's make her popular. It's that she would be on and ratings would go up. The record sales were through the roof. The songs were popular because people wanted to hear them more. And so the thing about the media creating that, I think that oftentimes people mistake that the media being a member of it, we're just a mirror. In a lot of ways, we're not cheerleaders in the sense of...
Oh, right. Absolutely. And I make this point a lot in The Female Brain, is that, you know, that girls who aren't out there buying makeup and clothes to look attractive because the media is causing that, the female brain... You know, as the male brain starts to use his area for sexual pursuit more and search out attractive, curvaceous females, which is what his brain is driving him to do, she, the female, is trying to look attractive to the male and trying to make herself be someone that the male would like to pursue. And
right.
those are how our brains are naturally wired. Now, in the media doesn't make these things happen. It plays upon natural instincts that we already have.
Well, and the need for scandal goes beyond the media. I mean, if there was no human
The human brain loves gossip.
If there was no desire for it, the media wouldn't do it. I mean, it is purely, in the sense, at least in the commercial media, it's a completely self-interested medium. If it only is interested in what will work and what's interesting. For example, you're interesting. This topic is interesting. You're on the radio tonight. But there are other books about the brain which aren't interesting, and or the people aren't interesting, and they're not. And so I think that's the same thing for why, you know, this teen idol becomes popular with boys. Why Justin Bieber, for example, isn't popular with boys is because he looks so much like a girl, and the average boy isn't just all that interested in that. But for girls, he represents something different, and that's why suddenly he's popular, right?
Right. So it has, you know, basically the media doesn't make something. Anything the media wants to put out there that's not picked up by in a passionate way by the public sort of drops like a thud.
Right. Exactly. Like I would have done with you 2 hours ago if you hadn't been such a terrific guest.
If we weren't talking about the male brain, which is probably your second most favorite organ.
You know what? That's an interesting guess. I'd have to really make a list of pros and cons on my favorite organs. But
and that yeah. probably wasn't the joke you posted on your website for
today. No, that wasn't actually. I might put it up there. I might have the heart and the brain and then other parts. But okay, I'll go along with what you're saying. Let's get back to the callers. Brian is in Maryland on Coast to Coast for Dr. Luann Brizendine. Brian?
Oh, hi. This is most of it tonight. It's nice to have a different kind of topic as opposed to like doom, death, and gloom all the time.
We'll get to that
yes,
next
thank
hour.
Thank you, Brian.
Don't worry, that's coming up when we do open lines.
A little bit of a complicated question, but I'll give it a try. It goes to the whole idea of epigenetics, homosexuality. Okay. You have a mom pregnant, just conceived. This is like, say, you know, third or fourth male child.
Male child, right.
And they're, okay, so we got, you know, boys in the house already, various ages. Now, what I want to know, is there any kind of, like, link between how much of a male child the other kids are? You know, their domineering personalities and... how boy or manly they are, and ability to have an effect on.
You want the nature versus nurture argument here, right?
Well, not really nature versus nurture. No. This is
how much is the conditions?
No. Okay, like how is that able to affect the actual signal transduction mechanisms and the whole epigenetics.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, I know what you're talking about. So there's this whole area, of course, of research these days called epigenetics. And what that means is it's a way in which things that every event that happens to us in our lives has a way of changing parts of our DNA called epigenetic changes. And so it basically the way that we're raised, the way that we're trained, the way that we're you know, all the foods that we eat, the environment that we grow up in, all of these things have an effect on our DNA, and it goes under the heading of epigenetic changes. So I think your caller is asking about how much of this, the research that shows that the third, fourth, or fifth son in a family has more chance of being gay than the other ones. How much of this may have to do with some kind of an epigenetic change that shapes that boy's DNA to be gay, and I think it's very interesting a topic that your caller calls in about. And bottom line is, scientists don't yet know about that, but I think it's a very interesting line of thought. And hopefully, your caller is going to be involved in some research in that. So we need a lot more scientists to look into these areas.
All, you know, what happened there, that's always what happens whenever the callers are smarter than me, and I have no idea what they're talking about. So thank you. Glad you're here. JoJo is in California on Coast to Coast. JoJo?
Hey, Ian. Great show. You're an awesome host.
Well, you're nice. Go ahead. You're talking with Dr. Luann Brizendine.
Yeah, I'd like to ask your guest what she has to say about the effect circumcision has on the brain and the male psyche, because I feel incredibly damaged and incomplete having it done to me. And I have read that it has serious adverse effects on the mind, not to mention the body.
Interesting.
Well,
I've never heard that before.
Circumcision, you know, circumcision is something that was very popular in this country for many, many years, and now has not been recommended by the American Pediatric Association now, probably for the close to the last maybe 20 years. So they're just to cut to the chase, there, as it were, there is a change in that in this country. Circumcision clearly is painful for the infant. And you know, being an intern in a hospital, I was certainly present during many circumcisions during my medical training on the pediatric units or in the OBGYN units. You know, the idea about what it changes in terms of the sensation of the penis, it's It's thought that the foreskin adds to a protection of the surface of the skin so that it doesn't become calloused, and by, you know, underpants rubbing on it and jeans rubbing on it all those years, because the foreskin covers it. So that's the current thinking in the field, and it doesn't seem to change, though, the ability necessary of the penis to function, or of the brain to feel, you know, intensely good sensations that you're supposed to be able to feel during sex. But those men with a foreskin have been shown to have slightly more intense sensation on the tip of the penis.
Anthony is in Boston on Coast to Coast for Dr. Luann Brizendine, author of The Male Brain. Anthony?
Hi, Ann. Hi, Doctor. How are you?
Nice to talk to you tonight.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for the show. I'd like to tell you about my problem, Doc. I went to the doctors. I had the same problem as Ian's friend there. I just couldn't function anymore. I didn't know what was wrong with me. My girlfriend kept accusing me of cheating on her. So I told my doctor.
Because you had lack of interest, you mean?
Right. So he gave me a testosterone test. Came back 75.
Wow, that's low for a guy.
Right. And I'm 40 now. That was last year, 39.
Yeah, so that's very low for your age, yeah.
All right, we'll give you Androgel. And then he was like, well, for me to prescribe you the injectable kind of testosterone, you have to see an endocrinologist.
Right.
So I told him the story. He prescribed it to me. Then I went back and took the test again, like 6 weeks later after doing the injectable. And it didn't increase that much. So he was like, huh, let's see what's wrong with you. Did an MRI, found out my pituitary gland was crushed.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you had did you have a little pituitary tumor or something?
No, I was like, oh, is that a tumor? And he said, no, it's instead of it flowing, it just spits out your testosterone.
Okay.
So I was like, how do you know how much testosterone does my body need? You know, and they go by like a chart or something like that.
Right.
Like 1200. I don't know, you know, if that, because.
Where do you stand now with it? What are they doing now?
The injectable, it doesn't seem to be working. 100 cc's every 2 weeks.
Yeah, so has he sent you to another specialist to see if there's, you know, something?
Oh, I didn't even know about another specialist. I thought the endocrinologist was the last line.
I was going to say that there's different endocrinologists. You might want to seek out one that specializes in male testosterone and male androgens. So that's a possibility.
Yeah. If you go to the Mayo Clinic, look me up, because a lot of people, for stuff like this, they may have to get the cutting edge research. It sounds like fairly unusual circumstances. Maybe the average endocrinologist wouldn't run into that very often. Ethan is in Salt Lake City on Coast to Coast for Dr. Luann Brizendine. Ethan?
Hi. I was trying not to crack up listening to your bumper music as it turned in. I'm a monogamously coupled gay man, and I've been married for like 1 year with my husband or couple or whatever. It's just interesting. This topic is just so interesting to me because I certainly think that, you know, there is so much to the male brain where one of us is, you know, not necessarily the more dominant or the more passive, but, you know, there's times when, you know, I will be more strong in terms of some situation or just finances or something like that, and he will be completely different. Does the doctor have any idea as to whether studies are out there, whether, you know, the instincts of couples or whatnot? You know, the oscillation between roles and, you know, that sort of thing goes on. And
really good question.
And then just the second part is, every time I kind of tell people that I've been married for like a year and it's a monogamously gay couple, people are like, wow, you guys are really not, you know, you guys have been together that long. That's like, you know, 5 years and 8 years. You know?
Yeah. Well, it is in the sense that, and you know that better than anybody. And I wonder too, whether Dr. Brizendine can address that in terms of the general, you mean, statistical short-term nature of monogamous gay relationships among men. that they often...
There are many more gay women who tend to be monogamous for long times. But I wanted to...
Right.
Let me address the issue of the playing different roles. I mean, even in a heterosexual couple, you know, if different individuals take different roles even at different times in the couple's life, you know. So whether he takes the role of being more dominant in some areas and his partner takes it in others... And that's kind of role division that goes on in straight couples as well,
yep.
well as gay couples. So I think that's probably nothing to do particularly with male or female brain entirely. And this issue of monogamy within the gay male world is well known to have, shall we say, a lot of promiscuity.
That'd be one way of looking at it, but the other way is to say that guys aren't wired to stay. This would be what my gay male friends would argue, and they would say that they just, you know, that it is like dog years to be for a year in a monogamous relationship.
It's a long time.
It's a very long time. I have a friend who's been together with his partner for 17 years, but they've had a lot of, you know, stuff along the side, a lot of relationships along the way. You know, they're still together, but they've had their dalliances. They both have.
So they haven't been strictly monogamous. They've had affairs.
Maybe I just, the response may for this may be for you, perhaps a future book on the gay male brain. I think, and I really mean that. I think there's a lot of people who are really interested in trying to understand.
Absolutely. Yeah. The very last part of the male brain is the gay male brain in the current book. So I hope that some of your listeners out there who are gay males would take a look at that and see what they think.
My wife and I, we switch roles in some traditional ways, one of which is I'm a very much of a process thinker in arguments and other things, that she's very much a bottom line person.
Mm-hmm.
Cut to the chase. What do we got to do? How do we fix this? Da 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 da. And it's like,
so
hey,
she's the fix it person in your life.
Totally. Let's get to Gene in Wisconsin on Coast to Coast for Dr. Luann Brizendine. Gene?
Hey, good evening. Or maybe I should say good morning. Happy Easter, doctor.
Yes, happy Easter to all of you, too.
My question is concerning the male brain, and, you know, and mainly concerning myself.
Okay.
You've heard of the, sorry, that is wrong, the fact that there are transgender people out there where there's the F to M and the M to F, where,
yes.
You know, what's your take on that? Because I'm myself, and it's made my life a roller coaster, but I know what I've been since day one, and family don't accept that too well. But, you know, I'm.
What were you, and what have you become, Gene? I'm sorry.
As far as I'm concerned, I've been male all my life, but got the wrong body.
Right, I totally understand. I just want to make sure I understand that. I think you'll like the book, The Male Brain. I think it'll be very helpful for you. Dr. Brizendine, we've got about 30 seconds for you for Gene. Go ahead.
Gene, yes. You know, of course, there are rare cases in which people have a male brain, they're born in a female body, and vice versa, and that's the transgender population, of which you are one, of course. And, you know, your gender identity is something that's formed in your brain and doesn't always match your body.
So understand them all better. The male brain and the female brain, two books by Dr. Luann Brizendine. Boy, I've so much enjoyed this. Thank you so much for being flexible and going with us in all these different directions we've pushed you in tonight.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We'd love to have you back sometime. Good luck with all the good work you're doing out there. And for everybody else, hang on. We've got an open line hour, last hour here. Don't know what subject you're going to bring up, but I look forward to hearing about it next. Grab an open line on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.